Land of the free, home of the brave. We sing it out at the end of the Star Spangled Banner. One of our most cherished freedoms is the freedom of religion. There is no state religion, and no one tells us how to worship, in theory anyway. But a lack of recognition of what worship is can certainly be found, along with some other issues. Our first guest this hour writes about the uneven distribution of religious freedom in America. Kiyathi Joshi is the author of White Christian Privilege, The Illusion of Religious Equality in America. Dr. Joshi is a professor in the School of Education at Fairleigh Dickinson University in northern New Jersey. She wrote a previous book, New Roots in America's Sacred Ground, Religion, Race, and Ethnicity in Indian America. Kiyathi Joshi, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
The people who say this was founded as a Christian nation, there's an interesting take you have on this. Explain it, if you would.
Well, yes. I think it wasn't necessarily founded as a Christian nation, but we do have this mythology that we were founded for religious freedom. And the truth is, we had Puritans coming here. They were escaping religious persecution. They were looking for freedom to practice their faith freely. They were in it just for themselves. They weren't really in it for the idea of religious freedom for all.
Which is interesting to think about on a couple of levels of the waves of people who came across the Atlantic, the idea that what I'm doing is right, the people who come behind me are not.
Yes, yes. And we've had people come across the Atlantic, and we've had people come across the Pacific. And immigrants have countered all kinds of hostility, and religious discrimination has been one of the forms of discrimination immigrants and refugees have encountered.
Now, you say Christian privilege in particular flies under the radar where other types do not. And what does that mean?
Well, because we have freedom of religion, Jeff, enshrined in the First Amendment, a lot of people believe, well, it's there on paper, so therefore it exists in reality. And that's just not the case. So I talk about religious freedom being an optical illusion, right? Because what does an optical illusion do? It first prevents you from seeing what's right in front of you. So we can see a religious discrimination, but we're not necessarily seeing it because in our minds we're like, no, all religions can be practiced freely. The second thing an optical illusion does is it kind of distorts what you're looking at, so it appears to be something else. And so sometimes we're talking about religious discrimination, but when it happens to religious minorities, only the racial element gets recognized and not the religious piece also.
That's a really interesting point. So it's like I'm not against them because of their religion. I'm against them because of some other reason?
Yeah. And we see that, for example, particularly since 9/11, with the treatment of folks who are Muslim or who appear to be Muslim in our country. But actually, the anti-Muslim sentiment, we can look back to actually the oil embargo in the 70s and the Iran hostage crisis and so on.
I remember Arab jokes during the 1967 war against Israel.
Yeah. I mean, it's been there for a long time. It got taken to a different level after 9/11. And actually, Sikh Americans, a whole different religion, you know, particularly those who are observant, the men who wear turbans have been really targeted since 9/11 and mistaken to be Muslim and faced a tremendous amount of hostility, violence, and even and been murdered.
So your book talks about Christian privilege, Christian normativity, and Christian hegemony. In the case of normativity, this is basically thinking of Christianity as the default, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's kind of like it's so normal, and the Christian way has become, you know, the American way. So having a prayer at the beginning of many civic engagements, you know, and sometimes, depending on the part of the country you live in, you might have prayers representing different faiths, but you would never not have a Christian prayer if there's going to be prayer. Because that is almost synonymous with being American, and that's what Christian normativity is about.
Well, and you give some examples. For example, there was a Hindu prayer, I guess, given in the Idaho Senate in 2015.
Yeah, and even in our capital in D.C., and it was met with hostility.
What kind of hostility? How was it expressed?
Well, in Idaho and other state legislatures, sometimes actual government officials have not been very kind, to put it mildly. But at the state capitol, when a Hindu priest was invited, actually at the, by Majority Leader Senator Reid at the time, there were people shouting, not legislators, not Congress folks, but everyday people protesting, saying that a Hindu prayer should never have been allowed, that we are a Christian nation.
Wow. You know, and I can see how we get here. You know, when you have a bunch of white land-owning Christians setting up the original rules for an institution, namely this country and all the sub-institutions within it, they will tend to move along with the kinds of relationships and power structures they understand.
That's right. That's exactly it. And that's what I'm trying to do with this book. This book is not about hating Christians or Christianity. This book is about making structures in history, in the law, in society today that are invisible, making them visible. And that's what I set out to do, because until we can see that, until we can see that, you know, how Christianity is embedded in laws and Supreme Court decisions, lower court decisions, we can't try to do something. We're under this farce where we keep thinking things are religiously neutral, and we're trying to be religiously neutral.
And here again, the book is called White Christian Privilege, but the Christian privilege is not there as much, at least if you're not white, it sounds like.
I'm sorry, if you could repeat that question?
The Christian privilege doesn't extend to people who aren't white. It's white Christian privilege we're talking about here.
Right. Well, so sometimes in the book I'm talking about white Christian privilege, and sometimes I am talking about Christian privilege, because we have communities of color who are Christian, right? Black Christians, Asian American, Hispanic. So they are also, they also benefit from Christian privilege, but then we live in a country that is very much categorized by race and organized by race. And so we have to look at all of this working within the umbrella of white supremacy.
Kiathi Joshi, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, her book, White Christian Privilege, The Illusion of Religious Equality in America. We're back with her in a couple of minutes. We have Summer Reads coming up in the back of the hour. This is the Jefferson Exchange on JPR. We were just talking about Christian privilege co-appearing with white privilege, and it has been very explicit at times, you point out. Tell us, if you would, Kiathi, about the edicts of the Pope in the 15th century, just as one example.
Yes. Well, the Pope put out, we call it the Doctrine of Discovery, and these were papal decrees that basically said any land not inhabited by Christians could be claimed and exploited by other colonizers. Now, I'm using the word colonizer. They did not use the word colonizer at the time, but by other European monarchs. And right there, you know, so it's basically saying, look at this piece of land, look at Oregon, right? And if there are no Christians living there, it's yours to take. Now, what is that, right? So Doctrine of Discovery undergirds then the idea of manifest destiny, which was all about, you know, claiming this land from sea to shining sea, and that those who came over and then those who called themselves Americans were ordained to do so by God. And that feeds into, you know, today's notion of American exceptionalism. There's a strong Christian foundation to all of those ideas.
There's an obvious flaw here, which is that if you take over land because you're the Christians and therefore the right people, and then you convert the people who live there to Christianity, as happened in many cases, mm-hmm. Then they should become an equal with you, it would seem.
Right, and that's what we tried with Native Americans first. Right, we had the Civilization Act of 1819 Congress passed that provided federal funds to Presbyterian missionaries to convert Native Americans. We then had for several decades, we took Native American children from their families and their communities to convert them to Christianity, to have them dress in an Anglo way, to essentially get the Indian out of the child. I think the phrase was to beat the Indian out of the child.
Oh, boy.
And it didn't work. Now, you had those who were enslaved from Africa brought over, And when those who had been enslaved converted to Christianity, that didn't guarantee freedom either. You know, so that's where we see the racial element come in. Race and religion in this country, whiteness and Christianity, they go hand in hand.
So let's talk about now, though. I mean, hundreds of years after the colonization we're talking about here, in theory, at this point in history, dropping church attendance and whites losing majority status should be changing things, you would think.
Well, those things are certainly happening. But the thing is that, when we're talking about privilege, Jeff, white privilege and Christian privilege, let's take both of those. White privilege is a product of systemic racism. Those who have white privilege today, folks who are white, have it because society has been constructed for them, because whiteness has been embedded into our laws and court decisions that provide advantage to white folks. And so similar things have happened with Christianity. So just because we have a decline in church attendance and we have perhaps by 2040 or 2050, different news reports say different things, white folks in this country becoming a numerical minority, that is not going to erase 400-plus years of white Christian privilege built into the structure of this country.
Kiafi Joshi, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is White Christian Privilege, The Illusion of Religious Equality in America. If you have some thoughts on the subject matter, join us by phone at 800-838-3760 or put your thoughts into an email at jx@jeffnet.org. You say the book takes a social justice approach to religion in American society. Would you lay that out for us?
Yeah, my goal in writing this book is, for me, I have one goal, and that is to build a more perfect union. And we often focus on religious diversity that is here, you know, and people think, well, because we do have so many different kinds of religion, you know, we're doing great and we have different houses of worship and everything's okay. Having that religious diversity is great, and certainly looking in your neighborhood and communities and seeing who's there is important. But the social justice approach takes into account that not everybody is at an equal starting point. Not all religions have the same kind of freedom. There are times where a Hindu temple or a synagogue has been has attempted to be constructed, and there's opposition from the town council or even the townspeople. So a social justice approach is saying, hey, folks, just because we have religious freedom in the First Amendment doesn't mean that's the case in reality. And let's look at the power structures and let's look at who has advantage and who doesn't, because then we need to work from that point. So social justice takes into account discrimination, bias, and privilege that exists in our country.
And the bias, even in how we talk about it, as you point out, you see differences, for example, in coverage of violence against members of non-Christian religions.
Absolutely. The way the stories are covered, the way people are depicted, and we don't even have to go, Jeff, to violence. Look at the way we think about prayer. Look at the way prayer is depicted, and when we think about prayer, usually it conjures up the image of someone sitting in pews, hands, you know, together, head bowed. Doesn't conjure up the idea of what my parents do often at the Hindu temple, which is prostrate themselves in front of the deities. And indeed, when we see images like that, you know, it's kind of looked at as, well, that's a little weird, or maybe they're a little fanatical, or that's just odd. Difference is not perceived in a positive way. Difference is perceived in a negative way.
In fact, you give a more plain out description of differences there, but just the dust jacket of the book of White Christian Privilege shows it looks like Michelangelo's God from the Sistine Chapel ceiling with the long flowing white hair and beard.
Right.
Nobody would think of just, you know, a generic God representation being blue, for example, like Shiva, isn't it?
Right. Or Ganesh, who is a half elephant, half human, right? And some religions don't have an image of God, right? So we have to, we're going to have to start learning about religion. And that's actually been one of the problems is that we don't necessarily learn about world religions in school, even though constitutionally speaking we can, but there is erroneous information out there that says religion shouldn't be in schools. Well, actually, one religion is there, and that is Christianity. So I am in favor of, can we bring in the other faiths to learn about them, right? We're not, this is not about believing in them, but it is about learning about them.
Yeah, so not trying to bring adherence into the religion, but you're saying just having people explain what we do in the religion.
That's right. How it's impossible to understand some parts of geopolitics without having an understanding of different religions.
So now we notice that people who say in surveys that they're not religious, or the nuns, as people have been calling them, N-O-N-E-S, I mean, how is that influenced by Christian normativity?
Well, I think it's important to understand that someone may identify as unaffiliated today, but if they grew up Christian, they still have Christian privilege. You know, they may not want it. Because it's about being familiar with things. And here's an example I can give you. I was when I was in high school, and I didn't do very well in English class in high school, so I kind of kept quiet. And one day, my English teacher, we were learning about similes and metaphors. And she said, blah, 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 okay, simile, metaphor, blah, blah, blah. You know, you all know the story of the Good Samaritan, and then just went on talking about similes and metaphors. Well, no, I didn't know what she was talking about. And I just figured, oh, here's something I'm supposed to know, and I didn't know it. Now, as a Hindu child, how would I know the story of the Good Samaritan? But that just shows, essentially, like Christian normativity. It's so ubiquitous that it's just assumed everybody knows it.
We have an email here from Diana, no town given. She writes, of all the men founding the country, some were Christians, some were deists, and some didn't say. The deists believe in a supreme being, but not a defined God as in Christianity. And yes, white supremacy from the beginning, since black slaves were brought here early on, says Diana in Ashland. You can join our conversation with Kiathi Joshi, the author of White Christian Privilege, The Illusion of Religious Equality in America, at 800-838-3760 on the phone, by email jf@jeffnet.org. You were talking about optical illusions earlier, the blind spots that people can have, or the warpings of the things that they believe they see. You say even church-state separation is an optical illusion, Kiathi. Can you roll that out?
Yeah, a lot of folks believe this phrase, separation of church and state, is in our founding documents, and that's just not true. It was put in a letter by Thomas Jefferson to a congregation that was concerned that we didn't have a state religion. And the thing is that because people erroneously believe that we're supposed to have this separation, all kinds of arguments and debates occur in society that I think end up being a waste of time. What the First Amendment says about religion is two things, right? There's the Free Exercise Clause and the Establishment Clause. And one of them, in a nutshell, one part of it is about keeping government out of religion. And the other one is about keeping religion out of government. You know, now what has often happened is that we see the Protestant emphasis and the Christian privilege coming through because what has been beliefs have been taken into account. But when it comes to rituals and behaviors, think about some things Native Americans engage in, then those haven't necessarily be seen, are not necessarily seen as religious. For example, the issue of land in this country. Land is sacred to a variety of Native American nations, indigenous peoples. Land is not sacred in Protestant Christianity. And so I think it's always been very difficult for those in power who are Protestant Christians to understand the sacredness of land. And so it doesn't matter if we're bulldozing over some, you know, what would be regarded as sacred land, because it's not seen as sacred by those in power.
Let's take a phone call. Alex in Ashland, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Kiathi Joshi, the author of White Christian Privilege.
Hi, I'd like to give an example of what I think she's calling Christian normative. I grew up in a community that was more than 85%, 90% Jewish, but the school system was run by the county that was unconsciously, I guess, immersed in what she's calling Christian normative. So when I was a little kid in school, they'd have us sing Christian hymns. I wasn't old enough to be offended about why are they making me sing these things, but it was kind of confusing. It was also kind of funny. I have a little anecdote where they had us sing this hymn, "The Wicked Oppressing, Keep Them From Distressing, Sing Praises to His Name, He Forgets Not His Own." I remember sort of thinking, these Christians are very easily impressed if they're impressed that God can remember His name.
All right. Thanks for the story, Alex. Appreciate that. But this is not, something you have not heard about for the first time just now, Kiafi.
No, but that is an example of Christian normativity. That's just it. You know, I mean, and you have several places where, you know, Christian students are not the majority, but you could see that happening. Less so now, but we still do know that prayer does happen on public school grounds even today.
Well, and there are some examples in here that, get beyond institutional, where it's not just like the school system doing something, but like, you know, the story of a teacher, for example, in the early 90s, you cite joking with a Muslim kid in the class.
Yeah. This was at a pretty prominent private school in Metro Atlanta, and a teacher was joking around with a student who happened to be Muslim, saying, "Hey, man, you know," he was carrying around his backpack, and he's like, "You don't have a bomb in that backpack, do you?" You know,
mm-hmm.
And the person, you know, when I interviewed the man, I mean, you could still hear in his voice, like, the absolute, like, how could this teacher do this? And of course, as a teenager, you don't want to stick out, so you kind of laugh along. You know, you stick out enough as it is because of your name and your skin color and a variety of other things that you just laugh along. But for teachers to joke around that like that, and while I talk about that happening in Atlanta in the early 90s, it has happened even since 9/11. It has happened in different parts of the country. So this is not something to attribute to the South, and it's not something to attribute to very long ago.
So let's go a little bigger here and talk about Newt Gingrich and the so-called Ground Zero Mosque. Let's delve into some of the assumptions that he and the people who opposed that mosque were making.
Well, that was really plain and simple about fear-mongering. You know, the mosque was a Muslim community center that was there already. It was not right at Ground Zero. It was about a mile from Ground Zero. But, you know, the religious right, a conservative segment of Christian America, they've been very good at messaging, you know. And everybody talked about it as the Ground Zero Mosque. Talked about how this is disrespectful to those who died as well as those who are living. And it flat out was saying, you can't be Muslim and be American. Straight up, that was the other message. So this is what we're having to constantly fight against.
Well, and I want to ask it, but before we go, about victimhood. I mean, it seems like some of the same people who say that other people use it to gain power declare that they are being victimized for being Christian. And I wonder what your observances are of that.
Yeah, I do definitely think that there are segments of our society where there is a bias against those who identify as Christian. There's a bias against religion overall. And I will say that universities, speaking as a professor at a university, you know, we are one of those places. Certainly, being religious is kind of sometimes seen as not as scholarly then. Mm-hmm. And I think that folks who identify as evangelical certainly have faced bias in certain segments. But to claim that their freedom, that they are having to fight for religious freedom, is another way that we can see how good they are with messaging, because they are not. My book, another way to read my book is to show just exactly how much freedom Christians in this country have because of the Christian privilege and Christian normativity that exists.
Okay, we're down to our last minute, Kiafi, and I just want to ask how we begin to put glasses on the optical illusion or correct our vision anyway.
Well, we're going to have to really start rethinking things. And in the last chapter, I offer a kind of a mini blueprint on changing the questions that we're asking, changing our foundational assumptions. And what I'm really hoping for is to hear from readers and listeners of the audiobook on how they are taking what I've provided in the conclusion and making it their own in their communities. So the book is definitely action-oriented, not just awareness raising and increasing one's knowledge.
Even before you get to even before you get to the action points, there's a real sense of question your own assumptions, and that is made clear about the assumptions that we have made over the years in White Christian Privilege: The Illusion of Religious Equality in America by Keyathi Joshi, who is a professor in the School of Education at Fairleigh Dickinson University in northern New Jersey. Keyathi, thanks so much for joining us on The Exchange.
Thank you for having me.
All right, it's been a pleasure. Short break. We'll be back with another edition of Summer Reads. Stay tuned.